This is the fourth segment, and I'm talking to Scott Stevens, and it's entitled, Look What the Cat Dragged In. And we've done this three times previously, and if you haven't gone back and listened to programs 1, 2, and 3, you need to do that to get all the information about Scott, but basically, I can tell you that he's an award-winning journalist, international presenter. He talks about addiction and especially alcohol addiction. And we started with this book talking about opioids and how alcohol was the gateway drug to opioid addiction. It all fits together fairly nicely. But we're using the Benjamin Franklin method of determining a difficult decision. And that difficult decision is, should I drink alcohol? And we're going to try to give you all the pros and cons so that you can make a decision. If you're not already addicted to alcohol, it should be a no-brainer. If you are, I can help you with beating the addiction. It's a little bit more sophisticated than just making a decision not to drink based on the Benjamin Franklin chart. If you've already started your chart, I'll give you some pointers today where you might add to it. If you haven't, go back and listen to how you set this up and get your chart going. Scott, it's nice to have you back on the program again.
Thanks, Dr. Henderson. My pleasure. And really enjoyed the conversation last week and like the prior weeks. And as I told you offline, I think the Benjamin Franklin decision T is just really an excellent way to approach this.
Yeah, so he was a very smart guy in our history, and he developed and invented a lot of things, and he had a brain on him. And when he said, the best way to make a decision about it is to compare all the bad things that could happen and all the good things that can happen. And if it just runs way one way or the other, it's a no-brainer. So that's what we're doing here. Let's get back. We left off with talking about fetal alcohol syndrome, safe levels in pregnancy, and now we're going to get on to car wrecks are the leading cause of alcohol-related deaths for underage drinkers. That means that if you're under 18 or 21, depending on what state that you're from, alcohol is going to kill a bunch of you, right?
Mm-hmm. Behind the wheel is where many of us focus on the problem with alcohol in this country. That, of course, began with Mothers Against Drunk Driving in the early 80s. They've made great progress. They've plateaued since then. The number today still hovers around 1 in 3 of the traffic crashes in this country, fatal crashes, are alcohol involved. And that number goes up pretty high for underage drinkers and, you know, a combination of, first of all, the binge drinking culture that we're in, but also, you know, their driving experience comes into play. But even the most experienced driver is impaired with the very first drink. There's a pair of studies that date back all the way to about the same time that Mothers Against Drunk Driving came to the forefront here. That demonstrated with professional drivers, closed track and all that stuff, that their reaction time was impaired beginning with the very first drink. So even if you're an older drinker, even if you're a very experienced driver, you're going to struggle when you're under the influence of a mind-altering drug like alcohol. And for the young drivers, it's a tragedy anytime we lose a person of any age due to something that's 100% preventable. But for families to lose a child or a teen to an accident behind the wheel, I per personally know several families through the course of my work that have experienced that, and it's heart-wrenching to know that there is an entire life ahead that was snuffed out but was 100% preventable from the word go.
Well, let me see if I understand you correctly. I think you said one out of three, or 33 1/3% of fatal accidents are caused by, or in one way or the other, alcohol is involved in it.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, so on your...
Yeah, here in the United States, where our blood alcohol level is 0.08, which is a political compromise. Other countries who've got a firmer grasp on the problem of mixing alcohol and gasoline, you know, they set theirs at 0.02 and some at absolute zero. There's no tolerance for any sort of alcohol in the blood system when you get behind the wheel in countries like Sweden. Now, that's beginning to change here in the United States. Utah, for example, dropped theirs to 0.05. I think California is working on a measure to lower theirs to 0.05 as well. But and part of this is the influence that Mothers Against Drunk Driving has had in this country since the early 80s, where the number of alcohol-involved fatalities on our roadways was vastly higher than it is today. We do have safer cars and safer roads these days, but the number today still hovers around 1 in 3, or 10,000, slightly over 10,000, as of the last year reporting was available at 2017. So the number of alcohol-involved crashes has reduced thanks to their influence and because we have safer cars and safer roads. But the overall attention that we pay to this has just exploded since the early 1980s with MAD, and we are paying more attention to the problems that alcohol causes, and that's a plus and a minus, because it's great that we're paying attention to this drug, but the damage from this drug, even in moderation, goes much, much further than car wrecks or cirrhosis.
So on my Franklin chart, on the left-hand side under risk, I put down a third of fatal accidents due to alcohol higher for 20 and under. And so the next point, two-thirds of alcohol-related deaths for those under 20 are from other causes like violence, suicide, and alcohol poisoning. Those aren't the traffic deaths. That's dying from other things.
Mm-hmm. That statistic, I dug into that middle of 2017 when I was putting together Look What Drive the Cat In, and looking at, you know, okay, yeah, this is a bad idea for teens to drink and drive. It's a bad idea for anyone to get behind the wheel in a state of impairment when they could damage their life or others. But hey, there's all these other situations that young drinkers put themselves into. Hey, grown-up drinkers do it too. We do. Alcohol is the drug that just makes you do dumb stuff. Ordinarily smart people do extraordinarily dumb things under the influence. One of the problems, of course, is increased incidence of unwanted pregnancy in teenage years, teen moms, teen dads, that sort of thing. A lot of alcohol involvement, or an increased risk of sexually transmitted diseases. Those things come with bad judgment, okay? But the other part of this, the part that just really floored me, is how much the use of alcohol increases a young person's exposure to violence and risk of death from violence. Whether it's putting themselves in the wrong neighborhood at the wrong time, or fights escalate under the influence of alcohol, and a person who might not be ordinarily prone to a fist fight, would get into one, or worse, you know, if weapons are involved. These are the situations that escape the microscope. But when you look at that statistic, two of three, that's a large number. So there are other risks for those teens. That violence number, though, that really set me back last year when I was digging into some of the more statistics regarding underage drinking. You know, we look at, of course, how underage drinking is going to influence the risk of addiction later in life, and that is a definite long-term problem. We look at the risk that underage drinking is going to cause development of the brain. Your brain doesn't stop developing until your mid-20s. It doesn't just magically stop when you're 18 as a statutory adult or 21 as a legal drinking age. No, your brain is still developing. So looking at how this affects your brain downstream as a teenage drinker is pretty dramatic. But look at instantly the decisions that are made by a teenage mind under the influence of alcohol that put them in dangerous situations for unwanted pregnancy, sexually transmitted diseases, and then this violence part on top of it. Boy, it doesn't paint a very good picture for this thing that we call a rite of passage for our young drinkers.
Yeah, I think that you said that people who haven't fully developed their brains yet, that by the time that they do, if they've been drinking, that they're 10% smaller than people who abstain.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know what that means, that you only have 10% less of a brain there, but it is an interesting statistic.
Yeah, what if you needed that 10%? Whoops.
Maybe that 10% was what would keep you from hurting yourself.
Maybe. Or others, definitely.
Yeah. Next point, adolescents need only drink a third to half as much as adults to suffer the same negative learning and memory effects. So that goes into if your brain's still developing, you don't have to drink as much to have the problems than if you did it as an older adult. Is that right?
Yes, in part, that's what it's saying. But also, you look at that's the time when that part of the brain is growing. So an older adult is already bathing their brain in this toxin, and those areas are already developed, so they're doing damage to those areas once they're developed. The problem with the underage drinking is they're damaging those areas, and in some cases on a permanent basis, before they're even developed. So they never have a chance to develop the type of reasoning, judgment, decision-making, emotional control, those areas of the brain that are still very rapidly and very important to success on this planet. And they're still developing that stuff, and they're dumping the toxin right on growing tissue. So that's where the downstream of this is, where, boy, you've got cells that are developing, and when we were talking about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, you know, it's the same situation, but only on a sentient adult or young adult who is still growing new tissue, and you're damaging it as it's growing or before it even has a chance to grow.
Here is an interesting fact. Individuals who start drinking after age 21 become alcoholics around 7%. The number jumps to 40%, however, for those who start drinking at age 15. And the average first use of alcohol in this country is 12.
Frightening. Frightening when you look at the average age of first use. Keeps going down. We have, you know, the average or the age of first use is 12 years and 2 months, and that's down from 14, not even a generation ago, just 15 years ago. So and here's what I'm getting at in a lot of look what dragged the cat in. We kind of blow this off. We don't make the deal out of it that it should be because of what we're talking about, the risk of addiction later in life, the damage to tissue on a permanent level, on that magic 8 inches between your left ear and your right ear. We dismiss underage drinking as some kind of rite of passage that, okay, well, it's better to learn this under my watchful eye in my own home, so we let them experiment, or we say, well, they were going to drink sometime. Thank God it was at 13 instead of 12. Well, wait a minute here. This is the danger that we get into by dismissing drug use, because it does increase the risk of addiction and long-term damage the earlier you start. So instead of saying it's okay for a teen to do it, or dismissing it as a rite of passage, or you know, all the other kids are doing it, the number of lame excuses we can make for underage drinking is longer than my arm. But the list of damages that it could do, including the risk of death and addiction and all these other health consequences, is much more dramatic than just that list of excuses.
Now, you talked about MAD, the organization Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and they did a survey, and that survey says that 74% of teenagers say their parents are the number one influencer on their decision to consume this gateway drug. But but if you have it in your home and you drink it, it's hard to tell your child, I can do it, but you can't.
You know? It is very difficult. You're the role model. You're the influencer as an adult to your kid, whether they're your own child or a child visiting your home. They're going to pattern what they see in adults.
And so if you want to make a really big deal to help the world, you start your own home by giving your children the facts that they need so that they don't get and run down this road, because the children are going to respond to what they see the parents doing.
Mm-hmm.
More than anything else, I think.
This is precisely why we don't need another go at prohibition or anything that comes as an edict down from Washington, D.C. or from our state capital to say, oh, we're going to ban alcohol. No, it didn't work the first time, although it did reduce drinking initially and definitely reduced the number of alcohol-related illnesses initially. But that's this idea that it starts at home is where we're missing the boat. There are parents that I've spoken to say to me, even after getting the facts, well, I'm a grown-up, I can make this decision for myself. Well, you are making it for your kids by patterning it, just so you know. And it is very difficult, as any parent can tell you, to pull off the do as I say, not as I do routine, because it doesn't work with kids. At kids, whether they're 2 or 22, it's not going to work. So if we begin our lessons at home about the health consequences and pattern our lives accordingly after those, you know, if you want to live a full life, you're going to, or a full and healthy life, you're going to reduce the amount of alcohol that you have in your diet or exclude it altogether. And if you want the same for your kids, you're going to pattern that for your kids.
One of the things in our country that I see is that the addiction of overeating is rampant. and overeating causes secondary diabetes. And when you combine diabetes and alcoholism, the likelihood of a fatal complication increases. So as we get more overweight diabetics that drink, we're going to have more deaths, more injury, illness, and more health cost problems. And it looks like that's the way that things are going these days.
Yeah, right. The disease of diabetes is going to increase the risk of heart attack, heart damage, or heart disease. Also going to increase your risk for stroke. And you throw on top of that the use of alcohol, even in moderation, increases the same things. Well, yeah, you're adding fire, you're adding fuel to the fire. As I said, that's the title of my third book. But when you look at the incidence of diabetes, and as you indicated, a lot of it driven by the amounts, our serving sizes, and the frequency at which we eat processed sugars, and all of the other factors that go into the increased risk of diabetes. I had a cousin who passed away at a very early age. He was in his 40s as a result of, he was a diabetic, and he decided to continue the binge drinking that he struggled with from time to time, but he'd always get really very, very sick from not just from the binge drinking in the morning after, but also from the complications it created for his diabetes, and in his death, he drank too much, too fast, but then the diabetic shock that put him into was it for him. It's a very sad story. It doesn't happen to every diabetic, of course not, but it does increase the complications that you have with this continually growing problem of diabetes, pre-diabetes in the country. By the way, alcohol does increase the risk for pre-diabetes as well. So that's something I wrote about in my fourth book, which was I Can't See the Forest with All These Trees in the Way. Looking at what this does to blood sugar levels, what this does to an important organ in your body responsible for legislating those blood sugar levels, your pancreas, and being a cozy neighbor to your liver in there is not a good neighborhood when you're dumping alcohol into your liver.
You said drinking alcohol, especially in larger quantities, contributes to diabetes in three ways. It reduces the body's sensitivity to insulin. It causes chronic pancreatitis, and it causes obesity. So these are the mechanisms that it gets you there.
Yes, absolutely. And the looking at how your body is sensitive to insulin levels, that's where the connection is made with all these different hormones that your body needs to work in balance. And by putting a toxin in, you're throwing that balance off with increased levels of estrogen as a result of drinking. There's a very delicate balance, as you know from being an MD, that these things they don't handle toxins very well, and that when your body is designed to work in a certain way, yeah, we're resilient as heck. But when you begin to, especially in an ongoing or a heavy amount of drinking, you're messing with that hormone balance, and there are going to be consequences. In the case of being sensitive to those swings in insulin, your body isn't able to detect them, so you're going to keep on doing what you're doing. You're not going to feel the incidence of an insulin spike until it's close to pushing you into diabetic shock. So, I mean, and ordinarily without alcohol in your system, that hormone balance would give you the heads up that, hey, I'm feeling a little lightheaded, or I need some sugar in my system. In the case of somebody who's drinking or drinking heavily or drinking on a regular basis, that warning sign doesn't come, or it comes a little further down the path.
You said alcohol complications and injury side effects put someone in the emergency room every 30 seconds. Wow. I had a career as an emergency room doctor, and I saw all the kinds of things that addiction brought in the front door, and alcohol was one of the worst. And every 30 seconds somebody's coming into the emergency room for complication of alcohol use. The next point that you made was binge drinking, and we defined that previously, has a significant impact on the immune system and its ability to heal. And, you know, if your immune system is down, it contributes to a whole lot of terrible diseases that can ruin your life. So just think about that then. Do I want to drink when I know that it's going to negatively affect my immune system? What would you have to say, Scott, about the connection with the immune system? Sorry for that. We had a battery failure, and now we're back ready to go. When the last thing that we were talking about was that alcohol negatively affects the immune system, and the immune system is what you need to continue to live a healthy life. So Scott, what are the facts about the immune system?
Well, it's as simple as you just put it. We need our ability to fight off disease, and when your body is busy processing toxins on an ongoing basis by the consumption of alcohol, you're taking away energy from your body to effectively fight off disease. It does lower your immunity, and this is where in oncology circles a lot of discussion is taking place. Well, part of the reason that your body may be more susceptible to diseases, especially cancer, could be the compromised immune system, where the body may be able to, on its own, ordinarily fight off the rapid or uncontrolled growth of cells by its own immune system. And once you compromise that by putting the toxin in your body, then those cells might not be able to do the entire job, or B, do as an effective job of ridding the body of what is also a carcinogen, alcohol being a known human carcinogen itself, but also your body's ability to fight off other carcinogens.
You said more than 10% of adults age 65 and older or binge drinking or heavy drinkers. That's not shocking, but that's a lot of older people that are more than just occasional drinkers. And mm-hmm. As you get older, you have more health problems, and obviously the alcohol is contributing to them.
The alcohol is definitely contributing to them, especially the things we don't ordinarily think about, the household accidents, the slips and falls, those types of injuries. But in general, when you have this combination of an older generation, which has a different view on alcohol use, and the amount of extra free time on their hands if they've retired or lost a spouse. You know, there's a part of their life that is gone. So the combination of that extra free time, and you know, if they're mourning a loss, and mourning the loss or the end of a career is a very real type of loss, no less significant than losing a spouse. And you know, we don't drink to feel good. We don't take drugs to feel good. We take drugs to feel less bad. So the number doesn't surprise me from those standpoints that you have this extra time, and you may be mourning or mourning the loss of a family member or a career, or just in general mourning the fact that you're closer to the end of life than you are the beginning of it. All those things are factors in there, but when you put into that equation already compromised health, then you know, the damage is potentially much higher than it is for someone in their 30s or 50s.
Let me give you the definition of heavy or binge drinking. 15 or more drinks a week for men and 8 for women. So go back and think about how many drinks that would be. One beer, 4 ounces of wine, one shot. How many of those drinks do you drink in a day, in a week? And you may not think about it unless you actually do this and actually keep track of it, because I know that most of the people that are overweight don't know how much they eat. They don't keep a journal of how many calories they put in their mouth, just like most alcoholics don't know how much they drink. And it surprises both groups when they keep a journal and find out what they actually are doing. So I would advise to do that so that you can know the truth about what your actual level of alcohol drinking is. Now, the next point, and I think that this is very important, alcohol reduces or adversely reacts with over 120 over-the-counter and prescription medications. That's why they say on a lot of medications don't drink with this drug, but you're putting yourself in the risk of having a complication by mixing one drug with another drug.
Mm-hmm. And in some cases, it can just cause vomiting or headaches or a little nausea, a little confusion. But, you know, that's not so little after all when you take into the fact that you're feeling that way because one drug you're taking is smashing into and colliding with another drug you're taking that most people don't even think is a drug. Take, for example, Benadryl. That's diphenhydramine, as my memory serves me correctly. You know, that is a really bad thing to be mixing with alcohol. And again, this is the goofy math where 1 plus 1 doesn't equal 2. It equals 6. Because of the effects of the diphenhydramine are amplified under the influence of alcohol. The same goes with benzodiazepines, which are it's a growing drug problem in the United States. You need to think of antidepressants or anti-anxiety pills. Xanax, for example, is a benzodiazepine, and mixing those with alcohol can be fatal. Because, again, 1 plus 1 doesn't double the effects, doesn't make 2, it makes 6, because it enhances or increases the effect of alcohol in the system. So where you might not be slurring your speech after one drink ordinarily, you mix that with benzodiazepine, and you could be flat on the floor, passed out, just because of how the drugs interacted with one another. we're not making or manufacturing fewer drugs in this country. We are coming up with drugs for every type of ailment, which could be defined as progress, but it can also have detrimental effects if we're mixing them with another drug, and especially when we, as a culture, barely recognize alcohol as being the drug that it is. These interactions aren't just for prescription drugs that are over-the-counter, like I mentioned, the Benadryls, and even things, herbal extracts that are, as we focus on organic wellness and taking things like St. John's root, which has an adverse reaction when mixed, or adverse interaction with alcohol. And that's an herbal supplement that's over the counter down at the GNC or in your Walmart or your Walgreens or your CVS as just something that, hey, well, the alcohol, the beer is in aisle 6 and the St. John's wort or Benadryl is over there. This is all safe, right? It's on the shelves. But when you start mixing drugs or remedies together like this, the results can be fatal. Definitely can have long-term side effects, lasting side effects. But the immediate consequence is very real, and it should be a wake-up call. If you're feeling nauseous after taking this mixture of drugs, well, don't do that.
Well, Scott, we're coming to the end of our time today, and I'll go ahead and wrap it up. We're helping you that are listening to these programs, this series, answer a significant question. And that question is, should I drink alcohol? And answering that question one way is going to present a certain set of circumstances in your life. And answering that the other way will present a different set. And you need to determine which set of circumstances you want your life to be. So we'll continue with the program, giving you the risk and the benefits, and hopefully one of these days you're going to be able to see that it's just not worth it. Scott, thanks for being on the show and giving us all the facts. You've got millions of good facts that most people don't know about.
I appreciate the opportunity, Wynn, and we'll talk again next week.
Absolutely. See you next week.
All right.